beating a man with their batons as he lies on the ground. Jose Velasco's mother says her son is mentally ill and was having an episode when she called 911. Police say Velasco was high on methamphetamine and assaulted his mother. In Iowa, a Des Moines police officer has shot and killed an unarmed man who police say was, quote, walking with a purpose toward her cruiser. On Tuesday night, police say 28-year-old Ryan Keith Bollinger led officers on a slow-speed chase and then walked toward Officer Vanessa Miller's cruiser. Miller fatally shot him through her driver's side window. In Louisiana, a decision to release the longest-serving U.S. prisoner in solitary confinement could come as early as this afternoon. Albert Woodfox's immediate release was ordered Monday by a federal judge, but delayed when the state appealed to the Fifth Circuit. Woodfox is a former Black Panther and member of the Angola Three, who insists they were falsely accused of because of their political organizing, of killing a guard. The guard's widow, Teenie Rogers, issued a statement calling for Woodfox's release because she believes he's innocent. She wrote, quote, I hope the appeals court cares about the evidence and cares about justice. The judge has already said this over, said this is over. Let it be over for all of us, she wrote. Albert Woodfox has been in solitary confinement for 43 years. The International Monetary Fund has recalled its negotiators from Greek bailout talks.
And hello. If you've just joined us, please stay tuned for our regularly scheduled program of Indigenous Talk Radio with the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
On the web, ang-newswire.blogspot.com.
This is APNS Public Radio.
The opinions expressed in dispatches represent the analysis of the participating editors and may not necessarily reflect the group positions of the ANG or its public news wires.
I think Angry Indian is one of those people who likes to walk up to two guys and say, let's see you and him fight.
All right, welcome back to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. This is the Angry Indian. There's been a lot of talk about, in the mainstream press anyway, about residential schools. Mm-hmm. They talk about residential schools somewhat in the United States, but not very much. Mm-hmm. Something we talked about at my dinner table. But you never really hear anything about it. Now, in Great White, north of Canada, they've decided to start listening to the First Nations people there about these residential schools, and accidentally, by bringing up the issue and talking about transparency, no one really, I think, believed that the First Nations were going to take this seriously and were going to actually pursue this. And, you know, it somewhat put white Canada into a bind where they had to start to deal with this situation. And as far as I know, you know, over the past 10, 15 years, I've heard it mentioned. There was a particular former Jesuit, I believe, that was running around, and he was talking about this. And he was also facing a lot of criticism in the Native community, at least in the United States. And I'm still not really sure why that is. But in any case, you know, right now we're going to talk to Samantha Nock. And she just wrote a piece on the Métis people, who, which is still really mysterious, you know, still a mysterious issue for, you know, Native folks in the United States, even for a lot of First Nations people in Canada. The Métis, you know, they have a very, very odd space within Native understanding, you know, politically in North America. And we're going to discuss that a little bit. But they also were sent to the residential schools. And they were also brutalized in the residential schools. And they were, you know, basically forced, you know, if at all possible, by any means necessary, to lose their identity as Métis people. You know, basically for the greater benefit of white Canada and for the British Crown. And Samantha Nock, thank you for being on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask you, you know, your article about this was really penetrating. And what led you to write it?
Oh, so my cooka, my grandma, she attended the residential school in Isle of Cross, which is our community in northern Saskatchewan. And we kind of had this, I don't even want to say it's an issue. It's bigger than an issue. We had this moment where she was going through the settlement papers. So a part of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and a part of Canada's promise of reconciliation was that Indigenous people who had went to the residential schools, the survivors would get a cash payout of whatever, depending on what they had went through in the residential schools. And so, you know, it's one of those things that's not perfect, but it's one of those things that seems good. And, you know, there's so much poverty and so much lack of funds in my family that, like, my cook'em heard about this and she's like, yeah, like, I want to fill out those papers. I want my form of retribution. And so we sat down and she had never really talked about her time in residential school because, you know, it's scarring. It's horrible. And it's not something we talk about at the dinner table. So we went through this process. We were working on these papers, and my family was working with her, and it turns out that she was denied because the school she had attended is classified as either a Métis day school, which a day school is where the students could go to the school during the day but got to return to their families in the evening, and not as a residential school. And yeah, was denied access to this grand national form of reconciliation and healing it was supposed to be. And so it's really tough for my family. It's still really tough to talk about with my family. And so just having the TRC come to its kind of end and hearing about it and it being constantly on the news, I felt inclined to write this piece just to be like, hey, you know, this is great and I never want to take away for what the TRC meant for survivors, but I also want it to be known that there are survivors that were left out of this process, and it's not a perfect process, and it's definitely not what reconciliation should be in Canada. Yeah.
Yeah, I understand. I mean, my reference to my own family discussing it at the dinner table mm-hmm. was there was no closure.
Yeah.
You know, there was never any closure. And mm-hmm. my grandmother, you know, talked a lot, you know, because she was from Oklahoma, a black mm-hmm. Indian from Oklahoma. And mm-hmm. she said, yeah, that when she spoke the language, they washed their mouths out with soap.
Yeah, my cook'em says the exact same thing.
You know, and they were yeah. beaten. Mm-hmm. And if they talked anything about, you know, being who they were, you know, outside of, you know, white society, what have you, mm-hmm. that they were physically abused. Mm-hmm. So she talked about it because she felt that she had passed a lot of it on to my mother, a lot of the self-hate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's the one of the issues I suppose that I would like to bring up, because there's so many things I would like to ask you about this. but as a woman mm-hmm. and looking at the treatment of women in 2015, we mm-hmm. have missing and murdered Indigenous women on the Canadian-U.S. border. We have missing and murdered Indigenous Spanish-speaking women on the U.S.-Mexican border, and then we, you know, are now talking about the residential schools.
Mm-hmm.
Has anything really changed in terms of the mainstream settler mindset? At all? You know, throughout the 500 years the Europeans have been here, has mm-hmm. anything changed at all with the new technology and, as you're discussing, this openness now? After looking at the South African model, you know, after apartheid, mm-hmm. of truth and reconciliation,
mm-hmm.
but these scars have never been healed, and mm-hmm. there's still no talk of healing.
Mm-hmm.
There's only like, okay, we talk about it, and we've done that, you know,
mm-hmm.
and that's it. But you know, what is to be done? What are First Nations advocates? I mean, people who are really on the ground with this, who are mm-hmm. dealing with folks who are still suffering and passing on this generational trauma.
Mm-hmm.
What did they recommend should be done at this point?
Oh, Just from the folks I've been around and the, you know, kind of the communities I've had the honor of being invited into, a lot of what I hear is turning in to ourselves and really reflecting in our own communities, be they our traditional communities or the urban communities that, you know, are a reality because of displacement and dispossession of our lands, that it's just a turning in and coming together ourselves and healing ourselves, and be that like turning to you know, traditional ceremonies or, you know, just finding ways to heal that kind of don't necessarily involve the state and kind of this great, you know, settler colonial idea of like, this has been a chapter in our collective Canadian history that we can turn the page on and we can heal from, and we can, you know, just put it in this kind of linear timeline and it'd be like, oh, here it is in the past. You know, we did this TRC. We went through this grand act of reconciliation and now we can move on to this new era of history. But, you know, like you're saying, in reality, these scars run very deep and they run in our histories through different generations. And from the people I've been involved with and coming from just the own communities I've been with, it's not that, right? So we all have these scars we're healing from. And from what I've seen, it's just been kind of on the ground together, you know, going through different types of ceremony, be they whatever people imagine ceremony to be, and healing together in a way that is appropriate to individual communities and individual people.
What would be the role or the, you know, the, well, okay, yeah, let me put it this way. What do you think, in your estimation, as an Indigenous person, should be the role of settler Canadians, the role of the federal government? Not that we expect anything on the harbor, but, you know, especially after C-5-1, I mean, it's impossible to expect anything on the harbor since the intelligence services of Canada view every Indigenous person within the Canadian confine as potential terrorists, as potential threats to the state. What is the average white person of goodwill? You know, what can they do in terms of, you know, really being proactive and being supportive of Indigenous people when dealing with these sorts of situations?
For sure. You know, I really think that just kind of like your average, everyday, like good-hearted, like I don't mean to be a horrible person settler could just support, you know, and support in ways that the community tells them to. And I think it's really hard for settlers and settler allies to really kind of take that to heart and be like, oh, I have to, you know, not go in with this idea of what I think I should do to help. You know, I have this plan and I want to help this way. But instead, sit back and listen to what these people are telling me to do in this situation. If that means not being involved at the moment and maybe just sitting and waiting until you're told what is appropriate, or, you know, being invited into spaces and being told, you know, you can be here, but you just have to, you know, be a witness right now. You know, you don't get an active role at the moment. I think it's just a matter of being open and being ready and receptive to help, but not necessarily taking that into their own hands and helping without really listening, or just, you know, still trying to play out those power roles of, you know, I'm here and I know what's good and I want to help, and I want to help in my own way instead of really just working alongside and working with Indigenous peoples trying to heal right now.
Okay, so that's, you know, a little bit of a question before we take a break. Okay. The Métis people, can you give us a little bit of an explanation, if not a history lesson, on who the Métis are? Because, you know, in the Indian country in the lower 48, we, you know, we've heard of the Métis, but we don't really understand, because, you know, you'll hear a lot of natives say, well, you know, this lady says she's Métis, but she had red hair and such and so on. She didn't look native.
Yeah.
You know, so there's a lot of assumptions that are made, and there's a lot of unnecessary prejudice, I should say. Yeah, could you elucidate for us a little bit on who the Métis are and how they fit into the First Nation scheme of politics in Canada?
For sure, yeah, I know. The Métis peoples as a whole are kind of an enigma, I think. And originally we come from the intermarriage of early settler fur traders and Indigenous peoples. And so that's kind of, you know, so there was the French fur traders and the English fur traders and the Scottish fur traders that took what they deemed country wives, which were indigenous women, and basically reproduced a bunch of mixed babies. And it was this interesting thing of the children, you know, kind of being outcasts of the growing settler society, but also kind of outcasts from the First Nations communities that were here, you know, just because of the nature of mixedness and how that plays itself out sometimes. And so they kind of created their own community within Canada and also the States. There's the Turtle Mountain Métis in Minnesota, I believe. Mm-hmm. It's so hard, like, it's hard to explain in a way. So created their own communities of together and kind of worked alongside our First Nations cousins and also with the settler communities that were here, because, you know, you kind of have relatives on both sides and it's interesting. And so the Métis are basically really confusing offspring of this. traditionally, we come from the Red River in Manitoba, so the settlements along the Red River. It's a really contentious definition, and I'm kind of struggling on defining it right now because it is so contentious and it is really politically charged right now, because there's kind of this politic that's happening in Canada with the definition of Métis, where there's this idea of Big M Métis, which is Métis nationalists, that, you know, we have land, we have in title, and we have this connected definition of being from the original Métis families along the Red River. And then there's this idea of Métis as in mixed, or little M Métis, who are non-status mixed First Nations people who identify as Métis, because for so long, kind of this idea of Métis in kind of Canadian consciousness has been of just mixedness of just settler and Indigenous ancestry, which is not true, but it's really politically charged to be like, Métis is this one thing and Métis is not the other, and I'm personally not comfortable putting my foot down on it, because who am I to tell, you know, somebody's mixed who identifies as Métis but may not be from the original Métis families, right, that they're not Métis. So it's just like, oh man, in that jumble, I hope there's a definition in there, because
yeah, it's part of being Indigenous in the 21st century, you know, for people like myself who are, you know, North American Indigenous African, right? And mm-hmm. and Black Indians have, like the Métis, have a really weird thing, you know, are we Black or are we white? Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, you know, are we Black or are we Native?
For sure.
But then we're not accepted, you know, in Native groups, many mm-hmm. of us. Mm-hmm. And it's not that Black people necessarily reject us, but they tell you to make a decision.
For sure.
Right?
The thing with Métis identity is I firmly believe that, like, Métis people are, like, the Métis people from the original territories. But I also have a caveat on that I would never, ever, ever want to tell somebody who feels comfortable, who is accessing their Indigenous identity, who's maybe coming to consciousness with things that have been hidden in their family for so long, just due to the nature of, you know, settler colonial Canadian society, that they can't access spaces that are Métis because they don't necessarily come from, you know, those families or that territory, or share necessarily the history of, like, the original Métis peoples. And so, I don't know, it's so complicated, like you're saying, and that's just the nature of being Indigenous in the 21st century, but it's hard, and not having a solid definition and not having it pinpointed definitely is going to be an even bigger conversation in Canada coming up, for sure.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about identity and how this relates to truth and reconciliation and to the horrors that, as far as I'm concerned, is genocide. It's still part of an ongoing genocide.
Okay.
Of the residential school system, mm-hmm. which was brought to us by people who said they believed in Jesus the Christ, you know, which is something else we can talk about. But yeah, we're going to talk about Indigenous identity and colonialism and genocide when we come back. This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio, and we're in the virtual studio with Samantha Nock. Please stay tuned.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
Hello, I'm Carol Gordon. Traditionally, healthcare and cleaning reproductive health was women's business and respected as such. Reclaim your healthcare choices by keeping yourself informed and sharing information with your relatives. Inform yourself about Plan B, known as the morning after pill. Plan B will protect you from becoming pregnant after a sexual assault or unprotected sex if taken within 72 hours. Make sure your local Indian Health Service facility carries Plan B. It does not require a prescription and should be provided upon request. It's your right. For more information, call your local healthcare facility. This message is brought to you by Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center.
Hey everybody, it's Dr. Vibe, the host and producer of the Dr. Vibe Show at thedrvibeshow.com. At our show, we do conversations and provide information for black men and those who love them. So come check us out. Also at iTunes, and also selective episodes are featured at the Good Men Project, one of the most viewed websites in the world for men. So find out about black men and those who love them at the Dr. Vibe Show.
Go ahead, ready?
I'm Forrest Whitaker for People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, and this is my daughter, True.
Hi.
Life is full of choices, and many years ago, I chose to become a vegetarian, and it's one of the best choices I've ever made. And since True's dad was a vegetarian, she decided to be vegetarian, too. You may decide to go vegetarian for better health, for a better environment, or you could be like True and I and just decide you don't want to eat meat anymore.
I love animals, and I love being a vegetarian.
I'm Forrest Whitaker.
And I'm True Whitaker,
and we're vegetarians.
For more information, visit PETA.org.
Something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speaking their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. What a field day for the heat. A thousand people in the street, singing songs and carrying signs, mostly say hooray for our side. It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Strikes deep into your life, it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you away. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. We better stop. Now, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. We better stop. Children, what's that sound?
Hi, this is Annie from Avoir Simone. You're listening to a Creative Commons licensed podcast.
This is FSNN reporter MJ Del Valle in Tbilisi, Georgia. Free Speech Radio News has been an essential outlet for my stories from the Caucasus region, including in-depth looks at the recent Armenian presidential election, the creative ways protesters in Azerbaijan are using to fight for freedom of expression and labor struggles in the Republic of Georgia. But FSRN, along with the voices of people struggling for dignity, equality, and human rights, could be silenced. Find out how can you support independent grassroots journalists at fsrn.org.
Listen to Angry Indian Radio. He is not only for Indians, but he is also for blacks and other minorities. And they have done a lot on the problems in Palestine and also the problems of blacks. And so I recommend that you listen to them.
Okay, welcome back to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. We're speaking with First Nations activist Samantha Nock. You can find her work at halfbreedsreasoning.wordpress.com. You can find her on Twitter at Samia Marie. You know, we're going to go further here. She wrote a very, very, very excellent piece that we're going to link to on the Métis people and residential schools and how this fits in with the new effort in Canada for Truth and Reconciliation that has basically been modeled on the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that was convened in South Africa following the fall of the apartheid government of the Republic of South Africa before the African National Congress took power. Not that anything has really changed in Africa. I mean, you have a new black middle class. The white upper class is not budge. They haven't lost anything. Anglo-American is still in power, never lost anything. The Oppenheimers are still in power. They haven't lost anything. Their company, De Beers, is still going through. There are more white people in the townships. That's one development that I know nobody really saw. Boers, who made up the majority of the working middle class, they were the police officers, they were the engineers, they were the mechanics, and of course, at being above a class, you had the British that were above them, the money classes, the landed gentry, the major business owners, the money makers, the bankers, and what have you. You know, you have a colored class. I mean, if those of you who are old enough to remember the former state of Rhodesia, there were plenty of mixed people that ran around that supported the white government. There was just a Pew Research study that was released, and it was reported on the Cherokee Reporter, that the largest multiracial group in the United States are white people who have a trace of Native American ancestry. But they also mentioned that these are also some of the most conservative people in Indian country, if they associate with Indian country at all. They tend to be voting Republicans. They are fiscal conservatives. You know, they don't like gay people. They don't like mixed marriage. And, you know, so, I mean, it's a pretty funny thing when we start talking about identity. And then we have the issue of racial dozal, which is not directly connected to what we're discussing in terms of residential schools in Canada. But the issue of identity is, for those of you who don't know, this is the president of the Spokane NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, which we can criticize all day long, and some of it is just, some of it isn't. But the issue here is that she's been passing herself off, this young woman, for 10 years as a African-American, and it turns out that genetically she isn't. She actually has a trace of Native American ancestry, but I believe she's a Scots-Irish and German. And, you know, when we start talking about the Métis people and, in my case, black Indians, right, for lack of a better term, Afro-Indio, in South America, the question of identity comes up. And then when you talk about genocidal issues in terms of the loss of land, loss of language, loss of culture, the destruction of family units, the fact that our ancestors are still being dug up and put into museums, all of these things. And then, you know, all of that came through my mind when I read your piece, Samantha. And, you know, when I think about Rachel Dozal and all of the folks, and I'm not particularly cognizant myself of how many settlers play Indian in Canada, but we have quite a few people down here who like to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you, as a Métis person, think about identity politics, and then you hear a case like Dozal's, what runs through your mind?
Oh, man. I think there's a huge, long, just kind of brutal history of people claiming indigenous identity or indigenous heritage when it benefits them. And I think that was obviously not the same, but what happened in Dozal's case, and also a very bizarre assumption of identity and politics that I can't even begin to wrap my head around where she was at with that. I have no idea. But it's so complicated because, you know, like you were saying, there's that study that came out that the largest population is, you know, mixed indigenous people who are white, but, you know, claim a little bit of indigenous heritage. And it's one of those things, and it happens in spaces all the time. And, you know, I think me as a very fair, very white passing Métis person that, you know, that's a question I have faced a lot. And I think if you are coming into those spaces and, you know, identity politics are going to be at play. And, you know, one thing I've definitely noticed that there's just checks and balances in community. And so you'll be in a space and you'll be in, oh, I don't know, say it's some sort of gathering and there's a bunch of indigenous folks around and everybody's chit-chatting. One of the first questions you're going to be asked is, oh, so where are you from? And that's not like, oh, so I'm Sam from blah, blah, blah. It's like, oh, I'm Métis from this community. And it's like kind of that like first check and balance people have for you when you're in that setting, because, you know, this has happened a lot over the years that people have lied and people have assumed positions and kind of hurt people because they have lied about their identities. And I don't know why. I really can't even begin to figure out why, but I think communities have definitely those checks and balances. But it's also complicated because there's such a history of dispossession and kind of hiding of indigenous identity in families that, you know, you could be somebody who is just beginning to understand a history that's been hidden in their family, and someone comes up to you in a setting and is like, oh, so where are you from? And you can't answer that because you don't know. But you know you have ties, you know that like you have ancestors there, and you're just like, holy crap, like, you know what, I don't know. And then somebody's like, oh, well, you're inauthentic, or like, oh, you're lying. And it's just so messy and it's so hard. And you can't blame people for wanting to protect themselves and protect their communities, because there have been liars and, you know, there have been people who have went through that have faked. And it's just like, oh, how do you even begin to, you know, sort it all out? Right.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is why, you know, I believe it directly relates to the residential schools, because the whole point was to whiten out, to whitewash indigenous people.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's been done to African people in North America, because I'm including Mexico, the United States, and Canada when I say this.
For sure.
And you know, it's been this thing. Well, we can't really change your skin tone, but the whiter you act, the more, you know, we'll like you, but we don't really like you, but we'll treat you somewhat better. You know, I mean, that was the promise to a lot of runaway slaves who made it to Canada, who made it to Nova Scotia in particular, and formed communities there, because the idea was, well, if I get there and if I can, you know, learn how to be a white Canadian, then basically things will work out for me. And what they ended up finding out was they still ended up being marginalized. So when we look at these reconciliation things, you know, and it's an obvious, it's a given that damage has been done, that generational damage has been done. But your article, I feel, really, for somebody who is not indigenous and who was willing to read the entire piece, you have to be, you have to walk away from that cognizant that what we're, expressing today in terms of the self-identification and self-acceptance of indigenous people and respect from the settler population is no different now than it was then. It's just, you know, maybe the genocide is just more subtle. But, you know, I don't see any differences. And, you know, you being a woman, in terms of how indigenous women are being treated, I mean, the case of Cindy Gladue is still burning me, for the simple fact that they brought her, I mean, the whole case was a sham, but they brought her actual physical remains into the courtroom as evidence when they could have sent in a paper report.
Mm-hmm.
Or an electronic report. There was no need to disgrace this woman this way and all other indigenous women on this continent. When I look at the residential schools and I see something like this, how can anybody separate the two and think that there's been any progress?
Yeah, I mean, that's a sticky one. I honestly don't even know where to begin to answer. Like, I think it is different now. It is different in the sense that I think with one of the positive things I will give the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and the entire nature of the TRC in the past, oh man, how many years it's been going now, is that it has brought this conversation to a lot of settler Canadians dinner tables. And I think it has made a lot of non-Indigenous folks in Canada kind of sit down and be like, wow, you know, this happened and this was an atrocity. And, you know, maybe this affected my coworker, or maybe this affected this, you know, this person I know through blah, blah, blah. Like, I think it's made a lot of people more cognizant of that. But it also, again, plays out the same idea of identity politics, where some people's stories were privileged over others. And I'm not saying it's a, you know, it's a authenticity thing, or, you know, people who look more Indigenous or, you know, more what people assume indigeneity looks like had their stories privileged. I'm not saying that at all. I think we had this grand thing happen, but we are still working on old definitions and old ideas of indigeneity and Indigenous people in Canada. So I think we are kind of three steps ahead and four steps backwards, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Like, we did this, but we still had so much other stuff that we have to do in order for this to really, I think, had been rooted in something that would have made settler consciousness a little more understanding, if that makes sense.
It makes perfect sense. And that's why I mentioned post-apartheid South Africa.
Mm.
The fact that nothing really changed except the window dressing.
Yeah.
You know, I could name the different people that were parts of the, that were cogs really of the new ANC government when it first came in under the leadership of Nelson Mandela.
For sure.
Who, you know, they did not, I mean, they were having, you know, pool parties, dinner parties with the Oppenheimers.
For sure.
Instead of saying, well, wait a minute, you know, many of our brothers and sisters have died in your minds.
Mm-hmm.
And what's really going on with the diamond trade?
Yeah.
You know, which is, you know, crooked to begin with. And then, you know, say, why do we have diamonds and gold and platinum and titanium and the rest of it, but 88% of the arable land still belongs to, you know, white people?
For sure.
You know, I mean, these are, as far as I'm concerned, fair questions. And just like here in the United States, we have a black president, Secretary of State, the Attorney General, this is the second one, and we still have no justice for people of color in the United States, let alone African people. Leonard Peltier still sits in a prison, and, you know, Clinton had promised to have him released before he left office. That was a lie. His wife is not running for president. He doesn't even mention Leonard Peltier.
Yeah.
Back to Canada here. You know, when we look at the cases like Cindy Gladue's and the thousands of missing Indigenous people, and the fact that anywhere from 60 to 80% of the prison population in some provinces of Canada are full of Aboriginals.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then we look at the residential school system. You know, it's like, how can Canada, in any way, shape, or form, not as individual white Canadians, or, you know, and whatever settler Canadian, you know, regardless of where you're from, you knew that this was Indigenous land, that this was occupied Indigenous land when you came. How can they possibly give themselves a pass the way Israel has just done with the new UN report, which absolved them of basically, you know, the murder of children?
Yeah.
They were removed from that list when they murdered children all the time. You know, how is it that Canada, whether Harper is in or not, it seems to be that no one is willing to deal with this situation. When will Canada, the United States, and Mexico, you know, face up to the reality
of what has been done to the indigenous person on this continent and what is continuing to be done.
Oh, man. I think, like, I think that I wonder that question a lot myself, and I just think, like, our communities are conscious, obviously, and I feel like definitely within my lifetime I've seen so much happen and so much fire being ignited in our communities and so much standing up and so much action happening that I think that is going to continue to rise in a sense. And I think the more that community starts speaking and the more that people start resisting and, you know, the more that people kind of come together and outside of kind of state mandated forms like the TRC, you know, kind of outside of those areas that are kind of okayed by the state, that then people will start listening. And if you think of the last few years of Idle No More in Canada and the States, that really shook people up. That really shook up a lot of non-Indigenous Canadians, because there was just these spontaneous protests, these spontaneous drum circles that were happening, you know, in shopping malls, on street corners, that kind of interrupted their everyday flow of commerce and everyday flow of life, that were just like, wow, you know what? Indigenous people are here and Indigenous people have things to say, and they will stop things and they'll make us listen if they have to, even if people are angry about it and even if people aren't necessarily listening in a way that they think is going to be constructive to themselves. But I think Indigenous peoples, we have a way of making people listen when we want to, and I think the more and more things are happening and more we're really going to tap into that. And I think once we start making people listen, that's when there's going to be some big changes. When that will happen and how long it'll take, I have no idea, but I think it's happening, and I think there's a comfort in that.
Okay, so what's next for you?
Oh, who knows what's next for me? I'm still trying to find a way where I can give back to my community, both my traditional community and the urban community I've been so happy to be a part of here on unceded Coast Salish territories in Vancouver. I don't know how and I don't know what, but I want to try and work in ways that are going to be helpful, and I'm going to keep writing and see what's up next. I don't know.
Yeah, well, please keep writing. And I really want everyone to go check out her site. She has a blog. It's a WordPress.com blog, Half Breeds Reasoning. I really advise you to check out what this sister has to say. And, you know, the protecting our truths, protecting our stories, remember to breathe. We are not failures. There's no such thing as a free lunch. Rethinking love as you work. I really want you to visit her site, halfbreedsreasoning.wordpress.com. And as I said, you know, look for her on Twitter. You know, go, you know, drop her a line to tell her what you think about her work at Sammy Marie on Twitter. Okay, so, you know, Samantha Nock, thank you. We will be looking at you and wish you the best.
Thank you.
Continue to do what you're doing.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me. This has been fantastic.
This is The Angry Indian, and we've been speaking with Samantha Nock, Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Please stay tuned.
Hi, this is Zesh9 from Zesh9.com, and you're listening to the Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. folks hate white folks. This is not about hate white folks. That you're going to need more than hate to sustain you when this thing begins. Now, if you feel that way, you're no good to us and you're no good to yourself.
Tried to make history a living thing and not a dead thing. I personally maintain that there is no such thing as ancient history or old history, that all history is a current event, and that everything that ever happens continues to happen, and every influence that ever influenced anyone continues to reverberate and continues to influence the world.
How does the knowledge of our history transform the mind?
Because the knowledge of your history tells you where you have been and what you have been, what you are and where you are. But the most important thing is that a knowledge of history tells a people where they still must go and what they still must be.
Only 28% of Americans believe in evolution.
62% want creation science taught along with evolution in our schools.
44% want creation science taught exclusively.
You are all about to learn that you didn't come from monkeys and slime. All of you were created in the image and likeness of God.
But didn't we evolve from prior organisms?
Yes, we did. Those organisms were named Adam and Eve.
Then why do we share 99% of our DNA with chimpanzees?
The Bible doesn't teach about chimpanzees.
What about redundant DNA and junk DNA? Does the Bible teach about that?
Well, I can tell you one thing. There's no redundant DNA in hell.
Our children are our future.
Let's try not to turn them into dangerous idiots.
In sad motherfucking news, freedom fighter Leonard Peltier was denied parole. Peltier is a member of AIM, or American Indian Movement, and has been in prison for more than 36 years for allegedly killing two FBI agents during a gun battle at the Pine Ridge Reservation. Peltier will not be eligible for parole until 2024. Our hearts are with you, hermano.
Idle No More calls all people
to join in peaceful revolution,
to honor indigenous sovereignty,
and protect the land and water
for generations to come.
Mexicans, South Americans, all indigenous people, get inspired,
take action,
and become a part of the solution.
It's my future,
your future,
our future.
We are the protectors of Mother Earth.
Stand up and protect it.
Stand up and protect it.
Stand up
and protect our earth.
Do not sit.
Do not sit.
Do not sit.
Do not sit.
And become a part of this incredible movement.
The time has come.
Idle no more.
Idle no more.
Idle no more. Become idle no more.
Voices Indigenous Radio brings to you the basics of how not to violate the law and presents the people who are fighting the war against Mother Earth. We bring the awareness of a different paradigm to the airwaves of WBAI as we shed the same old systematic paradigm that is killing Mother Earth. And you can hear the perspective of Indigenous peoples throughout the world and how they live with the law, land, air, and water. First Voices Indigenous Radio is produced in the studios of WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, streaming and archived on WBAI.org and First Voices Indigenous Radio.org.
Coming to you live from Northeast Jefferson County, Kansas. Your one true voice in Kansas. This is the Radio Free Kansas.
I'm your host, Mike Cadell, broadcasting from North Jefferson County, Kansas, smack dab between Kansas City, Topeka, Lawrence, Atchison. Easiest way to describe it. Put together quite a good show. Think you're going to like it.
Radio Free Kansas on blogtalkradio.com/fightingcockfire.
Why do you want to die, Grandfather?
Because there's no other way to deal with a white man, my son. Whatever else you can say about them, it must be admitted. You cannot get rid of them. There is an endless supply of white men, but there always has been a limited number of human beings. We won today. We won't win tomorrow.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
It's our news flash.
Apart from just getting rid of the superfluous population, it is a source of cheap labor. So prison labor is going way up. Cheap labor, you don't have to worry about unions, no benefits, they don't get out of line. And that also naturally undercuts wages elsewhere. So when just like forcing welfare mothers to work, you know, raising children isn't work, as anybody knows who's had children. So you have to drive them to work, kind of like people who go to, you know, Fidelity Investment to figure out scams about how to deal with the security market. You really want these people to work. But since there's no jobs for them, they're going to work at low paid or publicly subsidized wages, which will undercut other wages. And the same with prison labor. In fact, the scale of prison construction, which is a kind of Keynesian stimulus to the economy anyway, but its scale has become so enormous that even high-tech industry, you know, the guys who are usually just ripping off the Pentagon system, they're beginning to look at it, figuring out, recognizing that high-tech surveillance devices and so on may be another way to sort of get the transfer of public funds to make sure that high-tech industry keeps moving its